The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Season's greetings to you all with a Christmas-themed episode today. I'll be transporting you back to December 1944. But before we get started, as I huddle around my candle for warmth like a latter-day Bob Cratchit, I'd like to thank all those people who support the show via Patreon. It's thanks to you, my tiny Tim. Actually, it's not Tim, I have a daughter. We'll be having turkey for lunch on Christmas Day and not K rations. To become a patron of the show and receive extras, head over to patreon.com/ww2podcast. There you'll find a short video of me explaining it all and how it works. So that's patreon.com/ww2podcast. So as I charge my glass, I toast you all, and to quote Dickens' Tiny Tim, God blesses everyone. Hello and welcome to another World War II podcast. I'm Angus Wallace. I'm joined by Peter Lyon. In his book, American St. Nick, he tells the story of servicemen in the 28th US Infantry Division and their discovery of the European St. Nicholas festivities. Peter, thanks for joining me. Let's start with the US 28th Division. They landed in France in July 1944. They had a rough time.
You know, they were in England and Wales training for like 9 months prior to the invasion of Europe. And they did not go over in the initial wave. And, you know, obviously on D-Day, June 6, 44, they actually went over about a month later on July 18th. You know, give them a day to get their equipment together and whatnot. And they were in the thick of the fighting down in the Bocage country and down around Saint-Lô and just, and it was the hedgerow country. And it was just brutal, difficult fighting because it was, you know, your gains weren't measured in miles. They were measured in yards because it was just such tough going. And, you know, they kept at it. They kept fighting their way through. And eventually, you know, we hear about the Falaise Gap and the Falaise Pocket and all that, and they were instrumental in closing that. What that really was, they were in charge of trying to make sure that they prevented as many Germans from escaping eastward as possible for the German 7th Army, which is what they were up against. And so they were trying to close that pocket or that gap. Once they got through the hedgerow country, it wasn't clear sailing by any means, but they were, you know, they were certainly making up ground by miles versus yards. And it was difficult fighting all the way, but they, you know, they kept plugging through, and eventually they found themselves on the outskirts of Paris in a little place called Versailles, and that's where they were just prior to their march down the Champs-Élysées. They were a funny side story is they were in, as I say, the Versailles for the night before the Liberation of Paris celebration, where, again, we've probably all seen the archival film of the razor-straight rows of soldiers marching down the Champs-Élysées. That was the 28th Infantry Division. And the way the story goes was de Gaulle was coming back into Paris, you know, the returning hero, so to speak. But there was some question in Paris itself as to who was going to remain in control. Was it going to be those loyal to de Gaulle or those communist loyalists? There was a tension back and forth, and Eisenhower was concerned that basically Paris could fall into some civil unrest and basically civil war breakout. So he made the decision that instead of bypassing Paris, which was his plan with the 28th Infantry Division, instead to march them right down the streets of Paris as a show of force and a show of support for de Gaulle, but also, in a stroke of military brilliance in a way, was it the best way to move an entire division through from one side of the city all the way to the other, except for they literally walked through the streets of Paris and back right into fighting again on the other side because just, you know, northeast of Paris, there were still pockets of German resistance. So they were, you know, as Eisenhower was later famously quoted, and I'm not going to get the quote exactly right, but basically it was something like, you know, the 20th Infantry Division was the only case in history where a column of soldiers walked through a capital city in a victorious march right into battle that same day.
So they get quite knocked about, really, don't they, after that?
That was in August. And in September, they, you know, they march through Belgium and in Luxembourg, and then they find themselves, you know, at the mouth of the Hürtgen Forest at the end of October. And as we all know, the Hürtgen Forest, it was just a horrific place to wage war. Not that there's any good place, but, you know, the Germans have been prepping that forest since 38, building pillboxes and you know, mining what few roads there were through the forest. Most of them were logging roads. You know, reams of barbed wire, machine gun nests. They were trimming the trees. I mean, some of these trees were 80, 100 feet tall. And as such, their canopy at the top, the leaves would form to create almost this veil over the entire forest. It was dark and it was very foreboding. And this is where they had to, you know, they had to fight these Germans. The Germans wisely would prune meticulously prune the bottoms of some of these trees and shrubbery so it would allow them a clearer field of fire in what was expected to be these killing zones. So it was just, you know, some GIs call it a meat grinder, others call it the Hell in the Hürtgen and the Green Valley of Death. All those were so appropriate because that's what it was. It was an absolute meat grinder. The initial idea was that the attack in the Hürtgen was part of an overall battle plan that was going to send the certainly the 28th and previous then the 9th Division, in as a right flanking maneuver for an overall battle plan that would push on into Berlin and to the end of the war. But first they had to take the Hürtgen, and that's where the battle plan sort of went awry. It was only after they entered that they said, oh, well, yeah, the other thing about taking the Hürtgen is that by taking the Hürtgen, we can control these dams that are on several rivers. And the fear was that the Germans would blow the dams and therefore flood the river valleys and further prevent any troop movement in and through the forest and onto the Rhine. So they said, oh, that was another objective, when really there was no strategic objective to taking the Hürtgen because it proved to be a battlefield disaster. They committed division after division after division into this fight. It ended up being the longest running battle on German soil in history. And at the cost of thousands and thousands of lives. To give you an idea, the 28th Infantry Division, you know, an infantry division is made up of like 9,000 soldiers. Two-thirds of them were casualties of this one battle. So they have 6,000 casualties in this one battle, which is astonishing. So to say they got beat up was putting it mildly.
Now, they get sent to, well, a quiet sector, which is the famous quiet sector, really, isn't it? Sort of the Ardennes sector, and they get sent to a town of Wiltz. I presume it's Wiltz and not Wiltz.
Wiltz. It's pronounced Wiltz, but you know sometimes the Americans call it Wiltz. But same place, no matter what. They were in the Hürtgen for 2 weeks in the middle of November. They get sent to the rear. Now again, they're beat up and they're bloodied and they're battle scarred now, and they're sent to the rear back into Luxembourg. And the 28th Infantry Division, their headquarters is in this small town of Wiltz, which is this beautiful little storybook town. It's nestled into the foothills of the Ardennes, and it's a small little place, and it just leaps from the pages of just like this quaint German type fairy tale. It's a gorgeous little place, and this is what they chose as their headquarters. Now, interestingly enough, there's a huge house in the center of town. It was a private home. And this is what the high command chose as their actual headquarters, was this house. And the irony is that was also that house and the headquarters of the Germans when the Germans were in control of the town. So they basically swapped houses. But the 28th gets sent there. The infantry division as a whole, the 28th as a whole, was spread throughout sort of the northern part of Luxembourg. The 112th Regiment ended up in Wiltz. The 110th was up in Clairvaux. And in Wiltz was where the headquarters was, as I mentioned, and where the message center was located in this huge palatial house, which is part of the signal company. So the signal company message center guys, part of the headquarters unit, was in this house. And this is where the story begins, so to speak.
Were the troops billeted in the area, were they allowed to fraternize with the locals?
Good question. They were allowed to fraternize with the locals. However, high command was concerned that there may have been German infiltrators or sympathizers within the ranks of the Luxembourg people. And some of that concern was well-founded, because there were some instances, particularly up in Clairvaux during the Battle of the Bulge, where German sympathizers were there. So the command didn't necessarily say don't fraternize with the Luxembourgers, but they cautioned against it. Meanwhile, it was, you know, your common foot soldier, the everyday grunt, if you will, that was, you know, talking to these people and realized there was no worry about that, and certainly in Wilt, because the people of Luxembourg hated the Germans for what they'd done to them during the war. It's important to remember that when the Germans came in to Luxembourg, they considered Luxembourg really ethnically German. So they basically did away with the country. They called it Gaumoseland, which means the country district. And the Germans set about Germanizing the population of Luxembourg. Their official language of Luxembourgish became forbidden to speak, not alone teach. They couldn't even speak it. You know, their Luxembourg flag was dissolved. The government was now run by the Nazi Party. Any important administrative positions were filled by good, proper Germans. In 1942, they began conscripting Luxembourg military-age men into the German army. Most of those were sent to the Eastern Front to fight against the Russians. So this was very hard on the Luxembourg people, and they hated the Germans for what they were trying to make them become. So when the GIs came into town and as liberators, the Luxembourg people were only too happy to see these guys. There was no German sympathizing going on, certainly in Wilts, that's for sure.
And this is where Harry Stutz is. Harry Stutz is central to the story. He starts going around to locals for dinner.
They befriended some of the people in town, and this one guy, Harry, gets to know one of these townspeople very well. His name is Snyder, Martin Snyder, and he ends up having dinner at his house, and they have conversations. And Harry comes to find out through conversations that although the Luxembourg people are finally liberated after nearly 5 years of Nazi rule, that their upcoming holiday of St. Nicholas Day, which, by the way, had been forbidden for them to celebrate while under the Germans because it was not a sanctioned German holiday, so they were not allowed to celebrate this holiday. Harry comes to find out that although they are able to now celebrate it, because of the ravages of war, they have so little with which to celebrate it. Now, it's important to note here that the holiday of St. Nicholas Day is a town-wide celebration, meant mainly for the children. It's like Halloween and Thanksgiving and Christmas all balled up into one. And it's really a town-wide celebration where the children receive, sweets and chocolates and things like that if they're good, and usually an old twig if they're bad, but those are rarely handed out, where Christmas is more of a family celebration. So the town-wide celebration of St. Nicholas Day, which had been outlawed, was rapidly approaching on December 6th, but they really didn't have anything to celebrate. So Harry feels badly about this, and he says, there's got to be something we can do. We're the army, for gosh sakes. There's got to be something we can do. So he gets this idea in his head. It's like, why don't we throw him a Christmas party? And so he goes up to command. And again, he was part of the message center, as was most of the guys that he was with. And as such, he was in headquarters all the time. So he asked his sergeant if he could approach the captain. And he approached the captain to say, here's what he had planned. And the captain took it to the general Cota. And Dutch Cota says, that has to be a great idea, great for PR. Sure, go ahead, throw your party. So Harry now gets the official go-ahead to have this party. Now, he doesn't know anything about St. Nicholas Day. He doesn't know anything about Christmas. Harry's a Jewish soldier. So that's one of the ironies of this story, is that here's this Jewish soldier running around this predominantly Catholic country and town trying to organize a Christmas party, really, for the GIs, or a St. Nicholas party for the kids. And he just didn't know what he was doing. So he ends up going to the local priest, and he says, what he's planned, what he wants to do. And the priest is shocked by this. Not only are they the liberators and they're free of Nazi rule, but here's this soldier telling him, hey, we want to have a party for the kids. Well, the priest couldn't have been happier, of course. But he says, you should really go talk to the guys at the school, the teachers at the school, because they can you know, better coordinate. So Harry does. He goes and talks to the teachers at the school and finds out, you know, what would be the best time for this, what would be the best day for this. And they figure out it's on, let's do it the eve of St. Nicholas Day on December 5th. So they get all the plans in place. Harry gets a bunch of guys together to sort of form this little Christmas committee where they collect treats from the other GIs and, you know, whatever candies they can. They get the company cooks to make donuts and cookies, and they take these D bars, you know, from their rations, these thick Hershey chocolate bars, D bars, and they bring them to these nuns in the girls' school at the Wilts Castle to melt down and make hot chocolate. So he has this all planned out, but he comes to realize the one thing he really needs to pull this thing off is that he needs one of the guys to dress up as Saint Nicholas. He gets the idea, you know what, I'm going to ask my roommate Richard Brookins. That's who I'll go to him and say, you know, I'll ask him to do it. He'll do it, sure, no problem. So he goes over to Richard and he says, you know, here's what I'm planning, and gives him the whole lowdown and says, I really need you to play St. Nicholas. That's how you can help us out. And Richard promptly says, no, I'm not your guy. Get somebody else to do it. And the reason he said no was because he realized from listening to Harry talk about it that this was going to be a big celebration because, again, it had been 5 years almost. And he was afraid, Richard was, that he would somehow disappoint these kids and something would go wrong and they'd always remember this as some sort of laughing stock thing. And so he was, you know, I don't want to do it, get somebody else. But Harry was very persuasive and kept working on Richard. And finally, Richard acquiesces and says, okay, you know what? Fine, I'll do it. What do I have to do? And that's where, to this day, Richard will say, and then he sprang a surprise on me. He didn't realize he had to put on a costume.
What does St. Nicholas look like?
Well, you know, it's sort of like, you know, Kris Kringle, St. Nicholas, Santa Claus, however you want to do it. He ends up going to the nuns back at this Wilts Castle in the school where they're waiting for him on the day of the event. And they have for him the priest's mass vestments that he wears to say mass. That'll have to do. They don't have anything else. They made this bishop's mitre, a hat for him. They gave him a what's called a crozier, sort of a shepherd's staff, that, by the way, was held together with a piece of tape because it had broken off just at the curve. And the nuns knitted him a beard made out of rope, this scraggly, gnarly piece of rope that was itchy and was huge. But that was going to be the disguise, and that was going to suffice for St. Nicholas. And another surprise was they had two girls from the school who were best in class. They were chosen to be best in class, because they were best in class, rather. And they were to be his angels. And they would assist St. Nicholas as, you know, hold the robes and whatnot as he walked through town and whatnot. So that was how they got to see St. Nicholas that day. They plopped Richard into a Jeep and they drove him through town. Everybody could see that St. Nicholas was finally back in town. And they went down to the boys' school in the center of town, and everybody sees St. Nicholas is there, and they then take this jeep, and they go through town, and there's a procession that follows him, and they go into the castle where there's a, you know, circle of kids waiting for him, and he gets out of the jeep, and his angels are there to help him, you know, to make sure his robe doesn't drag on the ground, and there are all the other soldiers, and they're handing out treats, and they're handing out candies and donuts, and there's a guitar player there. His name is Hank Feibig. He's playing Jingle Bells over and over again. And the kids are singing songs, and they're doing little skits and poems and all that in honor of St. Nicholas, who finally returned to their town of Wilts.
And amazingly, the whole thing's filmed as well. There's a couple of combat cameramen. I've just watched the footage. Quite incredible.
And you know, Angus, that's one of the incredible parts to this story. As you know, as I said before, one of the amazing things is here's this Jewish soldier trying to pull off this, you know, predominantly Catholic holiday. That's one of the irony twists of the story. The other one is, as you mentioned, this film. There is actual film that exists of the original event from December 5th, 1944. And how that film came about is amazing. As you say, two combat cameramen who are out on assignment earlier in the day. They were out to film 9th Infantry Division troop movements into Germany and then a bombing run over the Roar River Valley. That was their assignment. That completed, they were on their way back to Wilts. Now, important to pause here and realize that Wilts is a very small town. There's a road that comes in from basically the south. It comes into town, goes into the center of town, wraps around the front of the castle, and then loops back out to the north end of town. And you could probably drive this entire road through town in probably about 6 minutes. It's that small. But they're coming into town, and as they approach the middle of Vilts, they could have taken a left and gone in, down the side street to the headquarters and dropped off their film and been done with it. And an hour later, they could have been drinking beers. But instead, as they're coming up to that turn, they see up ahead, coming out of the castle portal, they see another Jeep. And on the back of that Jeep, hanging out the back of it, is what looks like Santa Claus. That is not something you see in war-torn Europe every day. So curiosity gets the better of them, and they follow the Jeep down to the boys' school. And one of the guys in the Jeep elbows one of the guys standing next to him and says, you know, what's going on? And they explain what's happening and that they're going to go back to the castle. So the cameramen say, well, gee, we have some extra film on the roll. Let's go back to the castle. And they set up their cameras, and sure enough, the six-minute video that we see, or film that we see, it is this video that was shot by, or this film that was shot by these two combat cameramen. Now, I always like to take a moment and think about it, that had these guys arrived into town 30 seconds earlier or 30 seconds later, they would have not have seen this Jeep coming out of the castle portal, and we would not have this film. But as fate would have it, they did. And so that's why we have the film of the actual event. So, and in fact, as I always tell people, book signings and things, that, you know, when you read that passage about, you know, what's going on at that time during that little party, you know, it's not some author interpretation of what might have happened. I'm actually just describing what I see on film. You know, kids are laughing. Yep, there they are. Kids laughing. Hank Feibig's playing guitar. Yep, there it is. Hank, and I'm just writing that down because that's exactly what happened.
How did Brookins perform? Because he only spoke English. He didn't speak German or French or anything else. So I presume he just smiled and handed out candy.
Well, he did. He would pat the kids on the head and, you know, chuck them under the chin or something like that. He did have very basic knowledge of German because he had taken, a course when he was in high school. So he knew just the very basics. And, of course, he picked up a word or two since he'd been over there. And he also picked up a few words of Luxembourgish, the Luxembourg native language, as I mentioned, which had been forbidden for them to speak. But he learned to say a few words. So, you know, in the course of the event that was happening, he was able to, you know, ask a few very, very basic questions. But that's all that was needed because these kids, you have to remember, you know, they're 5, 6, you know, 4 years old. They had, you know, some of these kids had never seen St. Nicholas before. They've only heard stories. And here he was. And even just saying a couple of words, they were amazed that he was speaking to them. And it was a wonderful time. And Brookins, he'll tell you to this day that, for him, he was just a big kid. You know? At that point, he was just a big kid having fun. And they'd all forgotten about the war, and they forgot what was going on. And they were just a big kid having a bunch of fun with these kids. And that's at that time, all that they were doing.
Following this, I mean, we're very close to the Battle of the Bulge. He wasn't in Vilts Brookins when the Bulge, operation started, because I thought this was quite a good story. His story of he gets sent to Clairvaux, doesn't he?
Yes, he's, you know, one of the jobs that he's done. Now, when he's in the message center, as I said, this was the group from the signal company message center. When he's, you know, when he's there, what his main job is that he's running the a SIGABA machine, SIGABA, which was the American version of the Enigma machine. And that's what he did. He encoded and decoded messages all day long. But when he wasn't doing that, he was also tasked with showing films. A lot of times they were training films, but a lot of times there were also Hollywood releases. So he would go from regiment to regiment showing films for soldiers on R&R. And this particular time, he had a projector and he had the film Going My Way, the Christmas classic with Bing Crosby. And he was sent up to Clairvaux, where the 110th was, as I say, they were headquartered there. And he was sent up on the 15th of December. He got what they called TD, or temporary duty, up there. Didn't know how long he was going to be up there for. They had his mail forwarded up there. And he arrives there that evening. Next day, he was going to set up, and he was going to set up a schedule for showing films to the guys. So he goes to bed that night. He gets billeted in a hotel room with this one other soldier who he just meets, and a guy named Hugh. And they talk for a little bit, and then they turn in for the night. About 5 o'clock in the morning, they get rocked out of bed by artillery fire. You know, basically, shells are landing on Clairvaux. These shells are part of the initial salvo that begins the Battle of the Bulge. So this guy is front and center. He is right at the beginning of it. And at that time, nobody knew what was happening. Nobody knew what was going on. They just knew that there was some type of an attack going on. So he basically gathers all his stuff together, and he and Hugh get assigned as messengers, running messages from one end of the town, Clairvaux, to the other end of town, because communications had been cut. Nobody knew what was going on. So these guys were charged with running messages back and forth, and that's what he did for most of the day. And then it looked like at one point they weren't going to stop the Germans. They were continuing to come. So they were back at headquarters, and Colonel Hurley Fuller, who was in charge of the 110th, basically looks at him and says, look, you know, I know you guys want to get back to your unit. There's not much I can do to help you. We're pretty thin up here right now. So you're on your own, but you're relieved of duty up here. And he says to him, if I were you, I'd take that road to Bastogne as a way to get back. And at that time, that was the smart decision. However, we all know where the road to Bastogne led, you know. And what's important to remember here is Clairvaux was coming under attack because at that point there were two bridges over the Clairvaux River. Clairvaux straddles, sort of like straddles the Clairvaux River. There were two bridges that were wide enough and strong enough to support German armor. So the taking of Clairvaux was one of the key points of the beginning of the battle. And because taking those bridges would allow the German panzer divisions access to one of the only paved, relatively flat and unwinding roads in all the Ardennes, and that was the road to Bastogne. And so that was a key objective. So here's Fuller telling him to go take the road to Bastogne and get back to Wilts. So literally Hugh and Richard leave. You know, they're basically walking up the road. And not far behind them, maybe an hour or two, are the German tanks. So that's they narrowly escaped. And the only reason they were able to get back to Wilts was because they hitched a ride on a laundry truck. They just happened to be as they were going down the road, a laundry truck happens upon them. And at that time, the guys in the truck didn't even know there was a battle or an attack going on. They knew nothing about it. But they agreed to take the guys back, so they jumped in the back and they get back to Wilts on a load of clean laundry.
That was a very evocative part of the book. That I don't know why it really stuck with me, that little story of his escape.
You know, Angus, one of the interesting things, and I get called on this and questioned on this a couple of times, because there's, you mentioned that part in the book where just before he's able to get that ride on that laundry truck, he stops for a moment and, you know, he pauses. And again, these guys are running around all day long. They're hot and they're sweaty. And he clearly remembers that, you know, at that time, the mist and the fog had kind of dissipated a bit. And the sun was actually starting to poke through the clouds. And he remembers the sun coming down and warming his face. Now, people always say, well, wait a minute, the Battle of the Bulge was snow, you know, it was terrible. You know, it was blizzard-like conditions. And that's true 4 or 5 days later. At the very beginning of the Bulge, the weather was actually, you know, except for the cloud cover, which prevented the aircraft from flying, the weather was actually pretty decent. I think it was like 40 degrees and just slightly overcast. So it's key to remember that, because again, it wasn't always the hardcore snowiness that we've seen in movies and things like that.
Now, he does survive the war, doesn't he? How was the American? Well, obviously, the American Nick wasn't forgotten in Wilts after the war, was he?
One of the ironies that continues to this day, and again, is part of the irony of the story, is that during the Battle of the Bulge, the town of Wilts was overrun by the Germans once again as they pushed their way, you know, westward, and the 20th Infantry Division was forced to flee the area. When they finally beat back the German assault in order to dislodge them from Wilts and elsewhere, it required heavy bombing. And it was at that time that most of the town of Wilts, 80-85% of the town, was destroyed. And sadly, some of the children who had been at this Christmas party or this St. Nicholas party were killed by Allied bombing. Even so, the people of Wilts vowed to never forget the kindness and generosity of those handful of American soldiers that won St. Nicholas Day. So they decided that from that moment on, their St. Nicholas tradition in that town of Wilts would incorporate a new tradition. And that would be somebody from the town would be chosen. And it would be a great honor to be chosen to be not just St. Nicholas, but to be the American St. Nicholas. And they would dress him up just like the St. Nicholas did during the war, and they would copy the procession through town just like the American St. Nicholas did during the war, and they would end up at the Wilkes Castle just like during the war, and they would pass out treats to the kids at this party just like he did during the war. And that was their way of honoring those soldiers for what they did for the children of Wilkes that one day. This went on faithfully for 30 years. And on the 30th anniversary of the rebuilding of their town, they decided they wanted to do something special. They wanted to try to bring back those soldiers if they had survived the war. And that's really the story that gets told, is how they come about finding these soldiers. And in a nutshell, there's one soldier who's going back. He's in the mid-70s, the 1970s. He's heading back and retracing his steps during the war. He had been a POW, and he had been captured right outside of Wilkes during the Battle of the Bulge. And he's retracing his war years, and he just happens to be back in Wilkes for the night, and they find out that he was with the 28th, and they're very indebted to the soldiers from the 28th. So they say, well, why don't you come look at our museum? So he does. And when he goes to this museum, which is in the Wilkes Castle, they show him these pictures on the wall of this guy that looks like Santa Claus. And he says, they say to him, do you know him? And he says, no. And he says, well, he was a soldier in 28th, just like you were. You must know him. And it's like, you know, he's trying to tell these guys, look, there's 9,000 guys in the division. I didn't know him. And they say, well, you have to help us find him. And then they tell him the reason that they want to try to find him. And he doesn't know what to do. He's like, oh, okay, sure, I'll try to find him. And, you know, thinking, there's no way I'll be able to do this. But he finishes his travels. He gets home. And he gets the bright idea that, you know, why don't I call this buddy of mine who works for the phone company? You know, maybe they can look at their records or something. So he places a call and he says, you know, trying to find this guy. And, you know, here's his name and whatever. And sure enough, they find him alive and well and up there living in Rochester, New York. He calls the guys in Wilkes and says, hey, I found your guy. Here's his address. And they write Mr. Brookins a letter. This one guy's name is Gene Schweig. He is he's part of the people in Wilkes who was a boy. He was 16 at the time, and he remembers the event. And he writes Richard a letter and explains who he is, what he's doing, and that he'd like him to come back. And Richard, at this point, had no idea any of this had gone on. It had been 30 years since he even thought about the war or the Wilkes or anything. And you have to remember, when these guys left Wilkes during the Battle of the Bulge, you know, the battle plans took them elsewhere. They never went back after that. So this was the first time he'd thought about this event in 30 years, and it didn't take him long to say, yes, I'll return. And in 1977, he went back on the 30th anniversary as the American St. Nicholas once again.
It's just one of those random pieces of luck that happens, isn't it? I'll just give someone a call, and hey, you know him, no way.
Yeah. It turns out, yeah, as a matter of fact, it turns out that when this one soldier, Frank, just says, I got a buddy in the phone company, he calls him up. That guy in the phone company, again, it's just another one of those ironies of the story. The guy that he calls was actually the guy who trained Brookins on how to use the Sigaba machine back during the war. And says, yeah, as a matter of fact, I know the guy. He works for the phone company. So this is one of those stories that it had to have the exact confluence of circumstance and personnel and luck and everything you can think of. It all had to come together at just the right moment and just the right place at just the right time, and it did. And that's what makes this so remarkable.
If they'd made a feature film, wouldn't be surprised if it was all fiction.
You know, when I wrote the book, and the title was The American St. Nick, you know, there's always this debate that goes on with publishers, because they always want to have a tagline. You know, it's got to say something else. So it says, you know, American St. Nick, the story of da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, and I, you know, I kept saying, no, how about we just say a true story? And they actually hesitated, they said, that's a brilliant idea. And I'm like, I know, it was mine. I said, well, I said, no, it should say a true story, because people are going to read this. And I felt this, you know, when you write a book, you don't just write it, you rewrite it, and you reread it time and time and time again. And I kept reading it going, no one's going to believe this, because, you know, there are so many coincidences that have to come together, as I say. That I said, let's call it American St. Nick, a true story, to remind people as they're reading it, this really happened, just like you're reading it. These stories are true. The guys from the combat cameraman, that's true. Harry being Jewish, that's true. So it was important that people were reminded that, yes, this is a true story.
Bookings went back a few times, didn't he?
He has been back 8 times since that first time in 77. The last time he went back was in 2014. There's like 20 photos in the book of this through the years. The final photo is of him when he was back in 2014. And that's also when the documentary was filmed in 2014. So if you watch the documentary, which, you know, it airs certainly here on in the U.S. on PBS nationally during the month of December. And it can also be found at the World War II Foundation website, which is, I'm going to give them a little plug right here, worldwar2foundation.org. You can just download it and stream it there if you'd like. But it's if you watch that film, you know, you get to hear Richard speak and tell the story in his own words, but you get to see him on his return in 2014. And again, as we talked about, the original footage from 44.
Yeah, the original footage is brilliant. How did you find the story?
Interestingly enough, one of my close friends, his name is Terry Brookins, and he's one of Richard Brookins' sons. And I was talking with him one November years ago. He said he was taking his family on holiday to Luxembourg at the end of November. And I kind of scratched my head, like thinking, why are you going to Luxembourg in November? Why not Disney World or, you know, someplace like that? And because I didn't know a lot about Luxembourg at the time, but I knew it was going to be cold and it was going to be rainy. I just didn't think that was a great family holiday. And he said, no. I'm going over there for this thing my dad did during the war. And I'd always had a keen interest in all things World War II. I had, you know, many uncles that had fought in the war, and it just always interested me. So I said, well, you know, what did he do? And he gave me this 5-minute thumbnail version of the story. And by the time he was done, I was gobsmacked, just standing there, jaw agape. And just, I said, Terry, that's an amazing story. And he said, nah, all those guys have stories. I'm like, no, this one's remarkable. And, you know, someone should write a book about this. Hang on a second. I'll write a book about this. Give me your dad's phone number. And that's kind of how it started.
Brilliant. I mean, because so many people, you're right, everyone has a story, but very few people have a story and a piece of film to go with it, and it's, and a village that's looking for them.
And I'll tell you, and you can go back to that town of Ville, you know, today, and this year, next year, and it's going to be the exact same thing. Now, here's the thing. Since then, the event has grown significantly. Back when we were there last year in 2015, when we launched the book and the film and all that, instead of there being 30 kids surrounding St. Nicholas, this time there were 3,000 kids. So it's grown considerably. The tale of St. Nicholas is known throughout Luxembourg. In fact, the book has been translated into their native language, reached number 5 on their nonfiction bestseller list. So everybody in Luxembourg knows the story now. So they converge on Wiltz every December to witness this event.
That's great. As you know, as we're moving away from the war, so many of these stories are dying off, and people are forgetting. It's great that it only gets bigger.
Exactly. In fact, you know, that is the exact reason I wanted to write this story, because it's like I was honored to be able to tell it, but it was also deeper than that. It was as you say, you know, it's not going to be long before these stories are lost. And I remember Tom Brokaw, of course, he wrote the book The Greatest Generation, and he was asked one time, what connects that generation to this generation and generations beyond? What is that connection? How do you keep that connection? And his observation, and I agree with it, is it's in the individual stories that come out of it and the individual experiences that you hear about. You know, everybody, you know, you can go online, you can read all about the broad brushstroke major events, the Pearl Harbors, the Hurricanes, the Battle of the Bulge and Normandy and all that. And, you know, they get the great overview. But to really experience and get an idea of what it was like and how far we've come and just what took place, you're only going to know that through the individual accountings and stories from the people who were there. So to be able to tell at least some of those, and, you know, the American St. Nick, it is a, you know, by my own estimation, it's a wonderful, uplifting story. But there's also, you know, there's also some not so nice things about it. You know, there are some terrible things. I mean, at one point, Richard shoots 2 Germans, you know, I mean, and you tell that story. And to this day, he won't say that he killed them. He knows he shot them. So there's, you know, there's those experiences that are the way you connect people. And as you say, it's not going to be long before we're not going to be able to tell those stories anymore.
Yes, indeed. Thank you, Peter. Peter's book, The American St. Nick, is available now. I'll put a link on the website. It's not a long book, but well worth reading, especially at this time of the year. That's it for 2016. Thank you for all your support on Patreon, Facebook, and the kind emails. 2017 will start with a look at Jews fleeing Poland to Russia in 1939. Curiously, the story of Nachman Libeskind is far more uplifting than at first it might appear. So my best wishes to you all for the holiday season.